Deborah Lieberman, thank you very much for joining me for this episode of the COVID Tonic. I was very pleased to come across your paper on pathogens and disgust and human evolution, because I think that it is a very topical subject, since unfortunately we are still in the middle of the pandemic. So I thought that we could spend, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes discussing your very interesting paper on pathogens and disgust. So welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you very much. So let's start, so to speak, at the beginning. Can you explain the selection pressures of pathogens on human evolutions?
So when you say the beginning, it depends on how exactly what you mean by the beginning. So the pressures of pathogens, pathogens have been around from the get-go, and they have exerted strong pressures on all living organisms, and they have led to the evolution of some very interesting features and behaviors. Going all the way back, it's thought that pathogens are the reason why sex evolved. So instead of asexual reproduction, the idea that you get to scramble genomes and produce offspring of variable genomes thwart the effect of pathogens, that's one of the benefits that's thought to have outweighed the costs of reducing the probability of genes being able to successfully replicate 100% as occurs in asexual reproduction. So pathogens are responsible for the evolution of sex. Depending on your read of the literature and how you view the jump from prokaryotes, bacteria, to eukaryotic cells, they're also potentially responsible for the evolution of male and female. So you have a lot of interesting pressures that have been put on living organisms by pathogens, so disease-causing organisms.
So these are, please go ahead.
So once you have sexual reproduction and so forth, and pathogens existing in the environment, it sets up other types of interesting pressures. So ones that require organisms to now avoid becoming contaminated, infested with other types of disease-causing organisms or organisms that could take over their bodies and use it for their own reproductive purposes. And so we have evolved along with other animals and likely other kingdoms, mechanisms for avoiding these negative effects of pathogens. And this includes detecting their likely presence and avoiding them in various ways, cleaning and ensuring that we're not kind of carrying around unnecessary parasites and other microorganisms, but also it has affected the way we select sexual partners, ensuring that we are selecting partners that are healthy and are going to increase the probability that we produce offspring that are capable of surviving.
If I remember correctly from your paper, the key is that pathogens evolve at a much faster pace than we do. In other words, you have many more generations of evolution of pathogens inside the human body looking to penetrate and destroy those defenses. And and can you just explain how the recombination of the genes when obviously the sperm hits the egg, how that helps with breaking that cycle of pathogen pathogens attempt to destroy human life?
So when you are born, let's just start with the birth of one organism. And so we can even take Dolly the sheep. I mean, if you remember they tried to clone a sheep, but whatever, take any individual, take a human, and they, by virtue of being a human, you now have inherited a whole bunch of pathogens that are in, on, and around you and so forth from day one, right? So within the womb, as you're kind of exiting into the world, you now are kind of exposed to this environment that is inundated with pathogens. obviously we can't see them, but they're all around us. Those pathogens now have a whole generation in which to adapt to the internal biochemistry of the host. So as you were saying, bacteria and so forth undergo replication far, far faster than we do. So in any one, you know, given human generation, you have a gazillion of generations of pathogens enabling them to better adapt to the internal biochemistry. That means being able to secure resources so that they can replicate themselves, learning, quote unquote, how to avoid elements of the immune system so they're not destroyed. And so those pathogens that are more successful at getting resources, evading the immune system, are going to kind of exist in this host throughout the life of that host. And so now you can imagine at age, I don't know, 20, you now have pathogens that are really finely, you know, they've honed their skills in order to take advantage and exploit the host far better than they were able to at day one. But now at, you know, year 20, let's just say, for instance, you know, there was asexual reproduction and that host, you know, a finger, a rib, you know, dropped to the floor and started to sprout a whole nother individual, you'd end up with another individual who has inherited these pathogens that are already really, you know, finely tuned to that biochemistry, give them a whole nother 20 years to adapt, and they're just going to wreak havoc. Do that again in the third generation. I mean, you're just going to create a situation that gives an extreme advantage to these pathogens that are capable now of taking over the planet that is the host. But instead, if at year 20, let's just say, or 35, you know, you end up, you know, taking half your genome and another half of another person's genome and recombining them, you're basically pushing the pathogens back to square one. And so now pathogens that were really well adapted to the internal biochemistry, things look ever so slightly different from their standpoint at the level of, you know, DNA, RNA, proteins, and their ability to actually exploit the host now are thwarted again as that next generation starts. And so now you have an individual that's not going to feel the full effects of their ability to exploit the host because they have different kinds of genes. But this actually presupposes that the person that you've recombined your genomes with has different genes. And so sexual reproduction entails a lot of polymorphisms. And so the benefits of sex are due to the fact that there are multiple versions of genes that are different from the perspective of a pathogen's point of view, but not necessarily in terms of functionality. So they're still performing their function, but at the DNA kind of amino acid protein level, they look ever so slightly different, which provides an advantage to the individual from not, you know, feeling the full effects. But it also means, I'm sure you're going to ask me about this in a little bit, this is also why we don't tend to select close genetic relatives as sexual partners, specifically because mating with a close genetic relative is more like cloning. And so the idea is you're basically recombining your genes with someone who shares very similar kinds of genes. That increases the chances that pathogens are going to be better able to exploit that resulting offspring. And so you do find that children of close genetic relatives do tend to suffer a lot of defects. It's originally thought that these are just recessive mutations that can be co-inherited from brother and sister, for instance, and that is true, but the, I think, far more important selection pressure would have been from pathogens by virtue of creating a more similar environment that's hospitable to those pathogens who are familiar with the environments from the last generation.
That is what you in your paper call a physiological defense against pathogens. But of course, you are a well-known psychologist, and your paper is one that is focusing on the psychological defenses. So let's turn to those and talk a little bit about the psychological defenses against pathogens.
So in addition to an immune system, which would be part of the physiological set of adaptations that are there to combat pathogens, we also have what's been called a behavioral immune system. And so I call the behavioral immune system disgust. I think there's some debate in the literature as to whether or not they are synonymous, but I call them the same thing. And so part of our psychology is there to help us identify likely sources of pathogens and to strategically navigate them. And so pathogens can get in So in various ways. So not only can they travel, as I was mentioning just a moment ago, kind of vertically down the generations from mom to dad to offspring, from mom and dad to offspring, but rather they can also travel vertically or horizontally, sorry. And so how do you protect against this? So pathogens can get in and land anywhere, right? So a couple of the main portals are your mouth, right? So you can ingest pathogens. And so certainly our food psychology is a component of our food psychology is focused on detecting those pieces of matter, those substances that could potentially cause harm. Pathogens and rotten foods and so forth are exactly one type of substance that would have decreased one's reproductive success, chances of surviving and reproducing. And so that's not the only thing that would have jeopardized it. But in any case, pathogens are, you know, in foods are one source of problems, of costs that we had to deal with. But certainly touching things and coming into contact with things in the environment would have also been a one way for pathogens to get in. So putting one's hands into feces, you know, so not only just, yes, you have to touch feces in order to eat feces, theoretically speaking, you know, the idea that you don't want to touch feces, at least humans don't typically. And so
typically,
yes. I've heard stories. And so, but steering clear of things like feces and vomit and blood, guts, and gore, and preventing contact with that would have ensured, you know, greater protection against transmission of any pathogens. And so those are, you know, those are two ways pathogens can get in. And then the third way would be sex.
So before we get onto each of these, which is to say consumption of food, touching things, and finally looking for mates or mating, obviously physiological defenses against pathogens are heritable. What about psychological traits, what you call the behavioral defense mechanism? Is that also heritable? Does it come from learning, or is it something that we are born with?
So you mean inherited?
Inherited, yeah.
Yes. So these are pieces of mental software, right? So we have to come equipped with components of these mental adaptations and structures that guide learning in very specific ways. Otherwise, how would this learning ever occur? So I would say it's not necessarily a matter of learning versus innate or inheritance. I kind of sidestep that particular dichotomy to basically say it naturally has to be both. So genes are just genes. I mean, genes are just things in a petri dish, right? So they build structures against the backdrop of very sophisticated environments. And so all the while taking input from those environments in order to construct their systems. For humans, in terms of their particular systems that are part of disgust, so food psychology, contact psychology, and sexual psychology, each of those, you know, these are incredibly complex systems, you know, pieces of mental software, each requiring calibration, you know, starting from single cell all the way up to the, you know, fully sexually mature human. But the idea that naturally there's going to have to be some software there, some algorithms that are present that are going to guide what information is required in order to solve each of these problems. So it guides, you know, what counts as food. It probably has some particular strategies and rules that are built in to the extent that they were more foolproof over evolutionary history. You know, the presence of maggots and worms and things that are moving and wiggling was a really good sign that the meat you're about to eat is probably old and therefore contaminated. There's likely lots of these types of features that are quote unquote baked in, so to speak. And so, but the idea that observing what other individuals do, particularly trusted individuals, is going to be an important feature of these evolved systems.
Sure. And not just with pathogens, but like mom telling you, don't put a fork in the electric socket and things like that. But the reason why
mom actually did that. So when she was little,
The reason why I'm so interested in what we come into the world with already baked in is, you know, things like you take a bunch of monkeys who are raised in captivity and suddenly you introduce a snake into their cage and they go bonkers without ever having seen a snake before. And or a newborn baby lizard that knows that it has to run away from a charging predator, things like that. So I've always been just fascinated how much of that fear and disgust and other psychological traits we come in with already baked in. But it seems to me that you seem a sizable proportion.
Well, I mean, I don't even want to call it proportion. It's just that every component of this system requires, there's programming underlying this. So unless you actually have someone in your brain writing this programming, right, which doesn't seem to be happening, that programming has to be there in order to deploy in a targeted way. Better put, those organisms that had programming that deployed in particular ways tended to do better than others that either didn't have such programming or programming that, you know, led to less fit types of behaviors. And so it would be a bad strategy to have everything baked in with little ability for these systems to take in to consider environmental context, for instance. So to be insensitive to motion, to color, to smell, right? So if it doesn't have, so I would say that we have the ability to flexibly respond to components of our environment by virtue of having sophisticated underlying software that supports that flexibility, knowing what to do in different contingent based manners. So I would say flexibility comes at the price of increased psychological adaptations. And so humans are incredibly flexible with their behavior, which suggests that we have a very rich underlying psychology that's guiding what we eat, what we touch, and who we mate with. And so, yeah, I guess that's what I would say.
Well, so turning in to those three aspects, what we touch, what we eat, and whom we mate with. In your paper, when it comes to the section on food consumption, you discuss mechanical, chemical, and biological cues to pathogen presence. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. So, you know, as a disgust researcher, I have been kind of narrowly focused on pathogens. But when it came time to think about consumption, it became very clear that there's a far larger picture. The idea that, I mean, just think about a physical system that's trying to figure out, what do I consume that's going to, you know, increase my ability for, you know, respiration, homeostasis, maintenance, and all these different, you know, biological. And instead of just thinking about, we have a pathogen avoidance that leads to disgust, I think that pathogen avoidance and the disgust that it leads to is part of our entire consumption system. So you see any particular item, and you can evaluate it in terms of its, you know, expected value of consumption. Like, what is the fitness value of consuming this particular item? And so you can imagine that there's software performing a calculation of, you know, given the particular features that I can detect, I can estimate what the likely benefit is of eating this particular item in my current condition, in the current context. And so we have systems that are evaluating, you know, objects for, you know, sugar content, salt content, you know, and all sorts of things, proteins, but that's on the positive side. But the negative side is, what kinds of things could have hurt us? Things such as pathogens and disease causing organisms, but also, chemicals, particular chemicals could potentially be very dangerous, like poisons. And then you have other mechanical features like thorns and barbs and so forth. And so the idea that we have evolved different types of systems in order to detect the presence of these things. But by and large, once you, I would say, the detection of these positive attributes and harmful attributes have to be integrated in some way to generate a singular decision. Do I eat this? And so, you know, by hypothesis, it's thought that these all kind of get integrated by a system that's assessing the value of consumption. And depending on one's condition, how healthy one is, how hungry one is, the how punished one can be for consuming something, there's likely a system that estimates my expected value of fitness value for consuming this item. And when that's high, you perceive something as really yummy and scrumptious. Ooh, sugar and fats and yumminess, right? And, you know, but that's only when I'm really hungry, because after I've just engorged, you know, eaten five tubs of ice cream, the idea of sugar and fat, it's like, oh my God, I'm gonna barf, you know, get that away from me. Because the expected value of consuming this right now to me is very low. And that generates not an appetitive response, but more of an aversive response. Not as aversive as if I saw, you know, worms popping out of it, but an aversive response nonetheless. And when you evaluate something to have a very low expected value of fitness, either because it is, you know, mechanically, chemically, or, you know, in terms of pathogens, so whether it's a toxin or whether it's mechanically, you know, just looks like it would cause internal damage, or whether it exhibits cues that suggest that there are pathogens there, whether visual, olfactory, or so forth, that produces a very low estimate of expected value of consumption, causing the ew, gross response. And one of the challenges that I came across, that me and my co-authors have come across with respect to this model is, you know, another leading figure in disgust research had said, oh, well, you know, you don't experience disgust when, you know, eating rocks, you know, to a rock or something. And I think to myself, I don't know. I mean, I think if someone, you know, not a rock as such, you know, like I don't see a rock and go, ew, but the idea that someone picks up that rock and then brings it close to me and then prevents me from moving away and then tries to get it in my mouth, like, yeah, that's going to be disgusting. Like I'm going to, ugh, gross, you know, like get it away, stop. In the very same way that, you know, would happen if someone was bringing a, you know, spoiled milk to my mouth. And so I would argue that our initial reaction to objects out there might not be disgust, because they might not necessarily show as strong cues to being harmful or not harmful. But the idea that, you know, get them closer and closer and closer to one's mouth, and that's going to, you know, increase the negativity of all of those items. I mean, I'm holding up a little dongle thing here. I mean, like this itself isn't, you know, this little adapter thing. It's not disgusting, right? But then you say, would you eat that as food? And I go, I laugh and I go, oh, ha ha ha, no. But then it's like, no, eat it. And mm-hmm. So that'd be really gross. So in any case.
Even as you were pushing it toward the camera and suddenly it sort of was in my face, I was thinking, no, I don't want to eat this. But this is very interesting. So, disgust will also, the feeling of disgust will also be a result of those calculations that you were talking about. I was thinking about ice cream. So ice cream is something that is just absolutely delicious. So obviously I'm not experiencing disgust when I'm about to eat my first pint of ice cream. But after I've eaten two or three, and I suddenly see another pint of ice cream, suddenly I develop this feeling of disgust, because the set of calculations or the set of facts that go into that consumption calculations have changed. Would that exactly. be correct? Okay. That's fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I think we talk about this in terms of like the buffet effect. You know, you go to a buffet and it's like, oh my gosh, look at all this food, and you run wild and you eat as much. And then maybe you go for a second plate and then possibly a third, but you know, certainly, you know, by the fourth plate, it's like, oh my God, I'm going to barf. And so the question is, you know, that's interesting language. I mean, people are like, I'm feeling sick. And the idea that people are starting to use the language of disgust suggests that, you know, there is low value of consumption for the next morsel.
Fascinating. So that would be obviously what you call a nutritional state. In other words, depending on whether you're hungry or not, whether you really crave that ice cream or you've had two pints, that will contribute to those calculations. But you also mention prior experiences and developmental state. Could you discuss those, how those affect food consumption and pathogens?
Sure. So a famous effect, the Sosbernes effect, you know, that Martin Seligman has talked about in terms of past experience eating a particular food item, if it was bad, is something that will very much influence and update your calculation of expected fitness value of consuming again. And so once you're sick with something, or if you've experienced, foodborne illness, first off, what's very interesting about foodborne illness is, you know, as you are hovering over the toilet, what's going through your mind? You know, it's not like, oh, when are my taxes due? You know, or, you know, did I leave the front door unlocked? Or, you know, is he going to call me again? You know, it's not, those aren't the things. It is, you know, what did I eat? And typically it's like, oh, it must have been, you know, and typically it's not, you know, it must have been the bread, or it must have been the cracker. It's, oh, it was the fish, it was the meat, you know, it tends to be. So I find it very interesting, you know, that our, so you talk about the kinds of software and circuitry that's required. I mean, no one taught you to query that particular aspect of your day 4-6 hours ago, right? And so the idea, it's not like, oh, how hard or soft was the chair I was sitting on? No, it's a very specific part of that, of your behavior that happened a very particular time period ago. And so that has to be, that circuitry has to be there triggered when there is an indication that one has ingested a pathogen. But in any case, what was I just talking about?
And then the developmental state.
Oh, yeah. Past experience. So, I mean, everyone has a past experience with something. Most people, it's like tequila or something, although that tends not to stop people from having tequila again, but much later, certainly not the next day. And then with developmental periods, that's very interesting because certain types of foods pose different threats at different developmental stages. And so during early development, what you find is that children's neurological system is still developing, and secondary compounds from plants and toxins can very much interfere with and affect the development of all systems. And so children are famously, you know, very against eating their vegetables, much to the dismay of parents. But they've got good reasons for this, and that's because vegetables harbor a lot of potential plant toxins, toxins like cyanide that can very much influence, signals and the development of lots of different types of systems. And so children are resistant to eating plated vegetables. So this is one example of how a developmental stage can very much gear preferences. And so after systems have developed, children start to experiment with different types of vegetables, but certainly only after the window in which these systems are developed and calibrated and online.
Are there any other indications from nature that make us, oh, that's gross, I'm not going to touch that, I'm not going to consume that?
Right.
For example, smell or things like that.
Exactly. And so it ends up that, you know, the sulfur that bacteria can produce, we can detect. And so there's some interesting smells that are associated with bacterial presence. And then also the tactile cues of how mushy things are and whether or not, you know, the actual body of a fruit or plant has been compromised. But, you know, maggots are interesting, sort of, in the sense that, you know, you think about maggot, they're just these little, you know, they're just fly pupa, you know, they're soon to be flies. Why is that bad? And I've actually had this experience when I was in grad school, and it was a powerful one, which was I hadn't taken my garbage out and apparently had made, you know, some steak or something that ended up in the garbage. And I went to go change it and I saw these maggots, and that was it. I was done. But the question is, it was incredibly powerful. And maggots serve as a timestamp for how long, you know, you know, animate matter has, you know, so meat has been sitting around. And so that the presence of maggots and the size and the number of them is a good indication of how long a particular animal has been exposed to the elements and deprived of its own immune system to ward off pathogens. So I find maggots to be an interesting timestamp of sorts. But then you also have, you know, like you mentioned, there's smells and just visual cues that would indicate that something is rotten.
And mushiness, that would be something like instead of a hard pear, you have a mushy one that's disgusting, and you're not going to eat that. Would that be an example? The softer something is, the more likely it is that you are not going to eat it, or am I not getting it right?
No, I think you have it right, but it's all relative, right? And so the idea, I'm not going to eat a pear that's as hard as a rock. But I'm also not going to eat a pear that when I pick it up, it like, you know, basically falls apart in my hand. But then again, it depends on how hungry I am, right? If I haven't eaten for a long time, you know, if it's a pear is a pear is a pear. and I will take my chances depending on how hungry I am. So I think that, again...
Well, that's interesting. I keep on going back to this notion of yours, discussed as calculation or consumption as calculation, because of course there are plenty of examples of prisoners in the Soviet labor camps or in Auschwitz, or people who are who've been stranded on a ship somewhere, who will eat infected meat. They will flick off the maggots, but they will consume it because they are making that calculation. And I never thought about it in that way, but that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, yeah, you find, you know, people who have been stranded and what is it, the mountain climbers, the idea that suddenly now, you know, that person over there kind of turns into a big old, you know, chicken leg. So no, I think that calculations change our appetitiveness, or the appetitiveness of different kinds of substances, or another way of saying it, it decreases how aversive we find them. But if I can add in one thing that I think is important, that I don't know that is mentioned to the extent it should be mentioned in that chapter, which is, in addition to, so you mentioned your nutritional state, your health, your development and experience and so forth. But one of the things that's also going to factor into whether or not you find this piece of morsel, you know, appetitive is going to be, you know, what are the costs? So not only the chemical, mechanical, pathogenic costs of consuming it, but the social costs, right? So the idea is, you know, if I'm, you know, Jewish and keeping kosher, you know, milk and meat cannot be eaten together. And so, you know, you can't eat pork. And so the idea that I find pork disgusting, you know,
not my Jewish friends.
No, nor I. And so milk and meat, what are you talking about? And so, but that's because I don't have a group of people who can condemn me and exact, you know, some type of cost and punishment. And so I do believe that one interesting facet of human nature that might not be present, that doesn't seem to be present in other animals with disgust circuitry, because I do believe that other animals have this software, is that in addition to taking into account all these other features, we will forego eating something if it means we will be socially condemned. So this integrator has to, in some way, take into account the social costs. And you find that a lot of cultures and societies have, you know, certain taboos for certain foods. And so it's very interesting that, you know, the idea that we can use that in order to identify groups and outgroups and so forth. But it affects our food psychology, to be sure.
Let's now turn to the third part of your paper, which has to do with sex and mating. So humans, you argue, evaluate mates based on mate value, kinship, gender, and own mate value. So can you explain these in context?
Oy, how much time do you have? So So mating psychology, there's a lot that goes into that. So the way that I've broken it down, the way that I've broken a very complex system down is really just to talk about how humans assess the mate value of another individual. And certainly, so you identify an individual, you categorize them according to their, you know, their sex based on the features that they have. So we have procedures for determining whether people are, you know, male or female. And I think that once that assignment has occurred, then you apply a certain set of evaluations that go into estimating that individual's mate value. And so it's also possible, well, anyway, it doesn't matter. And so, but the idea is that for men, what types of features would have influenced their mate value and their ability to, you know, secure resources, protect, and, you know, invest in women and their offspring are certainly characteristics that have been well studied by evolutionary scientists. In terms of women, basically fertility, health, so cues to youth and health seem to be two major features that would have influenced a female's mate value. But basically, you somehow we are calculating mate value of other individuals. And this is one part of the equation that goes into whether or not we assess someone as a suitable sexual partner for us. Now, it ends up that we can assess the mate value of everyone. So as a woman, I can assess the mate value of every other woman, and I can assess the mate value of every other man. I can assess the mate value of kin, you know, and non-kin. So fathers can assess the mate value of their daughters for the purpose of, you know, setting a bride price potentially. But the idea that it's not necessarily, so it's an objective measure basically. But just because we can assess the mate value of all other individuals, a high mate value doesn't necessarily translate into a high likelihood that person is a proper sexual partner for me. So, you know, close genetic relatives, you know, I don't have a brother, and which is why I can talk about this so easily. And so, you know, my non-existent brother is really hot, and but yet he's not a good sexual partner for me, right? Because he has a close genetic relate, he's closely related to me. And so it ends up that an individual's mate value has to somewhere get combined with their genetic relatedness or estimates of their genetic relatedness in order to produce, just like there's an expected, you know, value of consumption, there's an expected sexual value. What is the expected fitness value of selecting this person as a sexual partner for me? And so a high mate value combined with a high genetic relatedness translates into a low, you know, sexual value. But remember, just as for food, context matters, right? So when pickings are slim, and so, but the idea that, I mean, it's not going to necessarily affect female mating psychology, but certainly potentially males more than females by virtue of the fact that there's less cost associated with any reproductive venture on the part of males as compared to females. But context very much matters. And so you mentioned one context, which is a person's own mate value. And so the idea that one's own mate value should very much set what, how attractive and your expected sexual value of another individual. And so that's been shown in a variety of really interesting experiments so that you can have, so Norm Lee, a colleague at Singapore Management University, did a study a while back where he gave men a wad of cash to hold. And so, you know, suddenly now this influx of resources, and it was a lot of money he asked these men just to hold. And now their criteria in terms of how attractive a woman was required to be to go out with them jumped. And so it's very, and this effect didn't necessarily happen for women who were given a wad of cash. It didn't increase the attractiveness of the man that they were, that they wanted to date. But it's just very interesting that, you know, perceived mate value, which can, it seems, be pushed around rather easily, is something that should affect one's strategies for selecting a mate.
Interesting. So the so close genetic kinship, mm-hmm. such as brother and sister, that would induce a feeling of disgust, preventing them from making under normal circumstances. then you could take it to, say, for example, gender, that a heterosexual male would not normally consider having sex with another male under normal circumstances. That idea would create a feeling of disgust, unless it is, for example, in an extreme situation, such as, for example, a prison environment, where these calculations may get flipped. Do I understand correctly how you think these behavioral patterns operate?
Yeah, I think that's right. So context matters. And so before I get to the jailhouse scenario, the idea that people are evaluating kinship, it requires that. So kinship isn't something that's necessarily written on the forehead, right? So it's not like I come into the world and there's an R of zero that you're seeing on my forehead. You have to infer that I am not a close genetic relative. How do you do that? And so part of my research has looked at how we figure out who our close genetic relatives are in order to have these natural aversions develop. And so it looks like for siblings, seeing the female who birthed and breastfed you birthing and breastfeeding another is a really great cue. That's my sibling. So whether you're 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, you see your mother pregnant and then give birth to and start breastfeeding an individual, that's a sibling. But if you're the younger sibling and you weren't around to see your older sibling birthed and breastfed and cared for as an infant, it seems as if the best cue that you have to go on is also a type of parental investment, right? So it's the idea that you're tracking who else seems to be getting cared for on average more, you know, by the same individuals who are caring for me. And so ancestrally, what I think, so my research has points to some interesting possibilities, which is that it looks as if it takes, if you are the younger sibling and you have an older sibling out there, it takes about 14 to 15 years of tracking who they're receiving investment from in order to get to the same certainty that they're a sibling that comes if you're the older sibling and seeing that younger sibling cared for and nursed as a baby. It takes 14 or 15 years to piece it all together, which is, well, first, it's two things. It seems to be right before sexual maturity, which gives me goosebumps every time I think about that, because that's pretty cool. But the other thing that seems to be, evident by that is, you know, why wouldn't that be higher faster? Like, why does it take so long? And it suggests perhaps, you know, our social ecology as hunter-gatherers, which is that children were roaming around and a lot of alloparenting could have been occurring. And so the idea of you have to sift between events of, you know, my parents caring for individuals reliably during particular periods of time that might be few and far between, you know. So if children are running around and getting food from here, from there, from everywhere, and sleeping over here, there, everywhere. So, you know, but when they're sick, they come home to mom, you know, or, you know, when they're hurt or they're scared, they come home to mom. And so these clarifying moments might be very important for detecting who is a possible older sibling in the environment. When there's a problem, who comes for aid and who, you know, who is my mom willing to help out? Who is my father willing to help out under those circumstances? And so the idea that it takes so long to figure out who your older siblings are is a question that I've had now, because anyway, so in any case, you see who your relatives are in a variety of ways by tracking parental investment. But the important point that I was trying to make is that if these cues are absent, even if someone is a genetic relative and these cues are absent, your mind isn't going to accurately classify them as a genetic relative. And so fast forward to modern environments where you have siblings who are raised apart and now they meet during adulthood, there are no cues that there are no cues present that they're in fact genetically related. In fact, they might find each other even more sexually attractive than the average bear for very interesting reasons. But whatever the case may be, the absence of these kinship cues prevents the development of this natural aversion. So it's not genetic relatedness per se, but it's the perception of the cues that would have correlated with genetic relatedness in the past. And so it works the other way too. So no cues, you know, with genetic relatives, no incest aversion or no sexual aversion, but the opposite of cues present toward non-genetic relatives will lead to sexual aversions. And that's what has occurred in, for instance, the Israeli, on the Israeli kibbutzim, where children were brought together, raised together, and they developed sexual, I mean, they were raised by the same caregivers. So the mind is like, ah, this is my sibling. And it ends up, they find each other less sexually attractive during adulthood.
So you noted in your paper that you exclude morality as a proper domain of disgust. Can you explain the interplay between morality and disgust and explain how your findings differ from previous research? Specifically, I'm interested in your statement that one need not feel disgust to use the language of disgust.
Right. Well, I mean, the backstory is when I started thinking about disgust, it came in three flavors: pathogen, sexual, and moral. And it's really been just having to think about the systems and the actual circuitry and information software, like, you know, the inputs, the integrators, the outputs, that really started to indicate to me that first, pathogen disgust is part of the whole system. And it's really just eating, touching, and sex as the different domains. But the moral component was always a perplexing one for me, and with co-authors and researchers as well. It's part of, so with Josh Tiber and other colleagues, we developed a three-domain disgust scale where we measure individual differences in pathogen disgust, so blood, guts, and gore, sexual disgust, but also moral infractions as well. So it's part of that scale. And there it will remain, but I do think that it's not a proper domain of disgust. And that's because it seems to me that disgust, by virtue of generating an expected value of consumption, expected value of contact, and an expected sexual value, that those three variables in the head and estimations that we create, those are what feed into the system for social value. So those actually can affect how much I value another individual. Do you come in contact with feces? Do you eat things that I find disgusting? You are someone that I'd prefer to not associate with. We have less overlap in the things that we enjoy, right? Are you attracted by things that I am not attracted by? So the idea that we diverge in ways that suggest that we would not share overlap, and therefore you would not be as valued a cooperative partner. And so we are constantly evaluating other people in terms of their social value. And I think that disgust, either by what you eat, by what you touch, by what you have sex with, are things that filter into this social value system and cause you to have lower social value for some people and higher social value for others. And I believe that this social value system is the morality system and what generates our moral sentiments. So I think disgust feeds into this system. And it can produce, so my disgust at something can produce a reaction that something is immoral.
Well, this has been absolutely fascinating, mind-blowing stuff. Love your research. Thank you so much for doing it.
You're welcome.